I'd like to call the Transportation Finance Policy Division to order. And we do have a quorum. The first bill up is Representative Simon. Do you have someone to move your bill,
I choose Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a co-author, so I'm happy to move the bill.
Representative Horton moved the bill. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll try to be brief because I know you have other bills, and I know that I've been instructed to save the fiscal note, which I'll try to do. But just by way of brief introduction, House File 8 is the False Claims Act. This is now its seventh committee hearing. And so many of you, I think the majority of you, have heard it already in one or more committees. So I'll spare the policy introduction other than to say in general terms what the bill does is it creates incentives for whistleblowers who report those who knowingly defraud the state. 22 other states have it. Republican governors, including George W. Bush as governor of Texas, has signed it. Democratic governors. It was originally enacted during the Civil War by President Lincoln as a way to get at sort of crooked contractors who defrauded the Union Army by sending sick mules and cardboard boots and all the rest. And so that's what this is about. So that's the general policy. I'll stick, Mr. Chair, to the fiscal note, though.
I was just going to mention, if you would, Representative.
I will do that. But just for the, I just thought for the few members who might not have heard it.
I believe they all have a copy of the fiscal note.
Okay. Yeah. And I don't know what's customary in the committee here, Mr. Chair, and I'll defer to all of you and your expertise. I would say you'll see that there's a $16,000 a year fiscal note. I would hope and I would respectfully ask that that be absorbed by the department and not carry with it any specific fiscal costs. I can go on and discuss beyond that.
Excuse me, Representative Simon, that's Trunk Highway Fund you're speaking,
yeah.
Please.
Yeah, correct.
If you'd stick to that. And you did get give kind of a brief explanation why did you do that.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, I guess I would first say I would hope that, in my opinion anyway, I think the fiscal note is the result of maybe some miscommunication. I don't believe, based on this detailed explanation, that the that MnDOT's explanation necessarily holds water as to why all these costs will be there. And I'm not looking to criticize or embarrass anyone. I'm just saying I just disagree, knowing the bill as I do. And I'll tell you why. First of all, I think what the fiscal note analysis fails to take into account, in my judgment, is that there's no retroactivity to this bill, so that certainly for the first year or two or more, I don't see there being, and other committees have agreed in other areas of the fiscal analysis here, and this is the last of the divisions that it's going to before full finance, by the way, and others have agreed similarly that there will be no great spike in cases because it only applies to conduct arising on or after August 1st of this year, if we were to pass it this year. So no one is going to be suing under this if they do on August 2nd, or probably September 2nd, or probably December 2nd, probably not for quite a while, probably a year or two or more. So certainly in this biennium, I just don't see these costs being, if other states are an indicator, I don't see these costs being there. Secondly, and MnDOT, to its credit, admits at one point that the figures here, quote, may vary widely, end quote, which I think is helpful, but also telling in another sense, too. The other thing is one section of the cost, in fact, $10,080 per year, is attributed to, quote, allegations from outside parties. And as I read the description of the bill, I just think there's a good faith misunderstanding of what the bill does, because the bill exempts government as a defendant. So, I'm sorry, I'm talking about the second category that says allegations of wrongdoing against MnDOT employees accounts for $10,080 of that fiscal note. But that isn't possible under this law. There will be no allegations against MnDOT employees because MnDOT employees are exempt. This is a bill to get at those from outside the government defrauding the government. Other bills this session are dealing with fraud from within the government. This isn't one of those. So I just think, unless I'm misreading it, there's a simple misunderstanding, and maybe it can be cleared up. I think $10,000 of those dollars are just based on a misunderstanding. There will be no, because there can be no, allegations of wrongdoing against MnDOT employees. So that accounts for $10,080. Then another $30,000 per year is accounted for here because there's an assumption that there will be a spike in Data Practices Act requests. And while I understand that if there were to be a spike in Data Practices Act requests, there might be some cost, I just think, again, as maybe just a miscommunication here.
Excuse me, Representative. Did you mean $30,000 or $3,000?
$30,000. So $30,000 is attributable here to increased data practices requests because, quote, more people may be interested in researching potential violations, end quote. But I don't think that would happen because a person in under this act, and it's the same in all 22 states, can't become a plaintiff in a case just by researching. In fact, this and all the other 22 states have in it a provision that says the whistleblower has to be a true whistleblower. It has to be an independent source, and it has to be someone who's really in on the inside. And by the way, that means if you look at the case law interpreting this law in other states and under the Federal False Claims Act, it means that it can't just be someone who, even within the company or entity, let's say, that heard it at the water cooler or heard it while in line at the cafeteria or heard the rumor buzzing around the office place, that person cannot sue under this act. It has to be a bona fide, real, honest-to-goodness person who was in on it, who is a true whistleblower. So I don't see, and I haven't seen in other states, and I've looked at the civil notes in other states, I haven't seen an instance where people are using their Freedom of Information Act, essentially like our Data Practices Act, to sort of troll around for information. So I just respectfully dispute that that would be a cost. And then finally, there's the $10,080 attributable to, quote, allegations from outside parties, end quote. But I think that I'm not sure what's meant by outside parties, but I do know that those wouldn't necessarily be from whistleblowers under this act. Most of the whistleblowers, if you look at all the other states and the federal government, are those who work inside of the entity. They're not third parties, they're not vendors, they're not someone else with a relationship. They're someone from within the company. So I'm just not quite sure what MnDOT means by allegations from outside parties. But I think what I really want to get across, Mr. Chair and members, is allegations of wrongdoing against MnDOT employees, that's not this bill. It couldn't qualify to them, and the language as it stands now doesn't extend to them at all. So that $10,000 ought to go away. And then I'm just dubious personally of the $30,000 attributable to some sort of spike in Data Practices Act request. And even if you buy that there would be such a spike, which I would respectfully say there wouldn't be, I just have a real hard time believing in the first year or two or three of this law there would be a spike because there's no retroactivity. It only applies to conduct on or after August 1st of this year if we were to pass it this year. So I leave it in your hands, members, and thanks for your time.
Thank you. And again, I remind the committee that we are concerned about the financial aspects, and Representative Simon has given a description of the bill, so confine your questions to what we deal with. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with Representative Simon that the fiscal note probably is a little off, and in one other regard, I think it's a little off, and the presumption is that each valid violation would only recover $20,000, and I think in the types of contracting projects that we're talking about that MnDOT does, assuming that we would only recover $20,000 when somebody's fraudulently making a claim is probably a low assumption. So I would agree with Representative Simon that there should not be a fiscal impact on the Trunk Highway Fund.
Any further questions? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to hear from MnDOT. A number of things were stated by the author, and I'd like them to have an opportunity to respond. But I do have a question. If there are funds recovered, do they go to the Trunk Highway Fund or do they go to the general fund?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's another thing we haven't discussed. Generally, they would go to the general fund.
Right.
So both on the expense side and possibly on the income side, I guess you would say, I think there are some things that we need to talk about. Now, I will say that no one talked to me from MnDOT before this came out. I was actually very surprised to see a MnDOT fiscal cost because I had talked with the courts, I had talked with the Department of Administration, I had talked with DHS, and I had talked indirectly, at least, with the Attorney General's Office. Senator Lass, the co-author in the chief author in the Senate, has dealt with the Attorney General's Office. So I was surprised to get this fiscal note, and even up until this hearing, no one has contacted me to ask me about the bill. And I'm happy to have that discussion. It's a little late now, but I think you're right.
Well,
they should explain
themselves. Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I hate when we lose money out of the Trunk Highway Fund. And if it's a MnDOT action and it's related to a contract in which the funds that paid for the contract were Trunk Highway funds, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that the any proceeds recovered from the bad actor would go to the general fund. In fact, constitutionally, I'm wondering if it would have to go back to the Trunk Highway Fund, if not, in fact, into the exact fund that it was taken from, whether it be MSA or county state aid or whatever. So, and I'm not sure how this interacts also with if it applies to contracts that were let by the county. Can you talk a little bit about that? We fund through MnDOT, but we send all this money out to counties and cities and transit providers, et cetera. So how does that interaction work?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In part, we're on some uncharted territory because there are very, very few False Claims Act cases that are brought in the transportation context that I've seen. There's one big one that I've seen that got a lot of headlines, and that was on the big dig in Boston, huge public works project. There was a False Claims Act case against one of the contractors there. But I know of none on the state level. That doesn't mean there were any, but I've looked and I can't find any. That's one of the reasons I was surprised to see a fiscal cost that implied all this activity. But let me tell you how that would probably work if that were to happen. So a whistleblower would come forward, let's say it was on a county level, alleging that she was, you know, had this information, would file a complaint. The Attorney General will then have 60 days or more, because they can go for an extension under this bill, to decide whether they wanted to intervene in the case. And that's the way it is in all 22 states in the federal government. In the vast, vast majority of cases, I think at the federal level, it's 85% or north of that, they decide not to. Because the very reason for this law is to let others stand in the shoes of the government and not take up government resources on these. But once in a while, the federal government or the states do decide to intervene, and I think that's what would happen here as well. So the AG's office would have the chance to take a look, decide if they wanted to intervene. If not, which is more likely than not, then the private plaintiff would stand in the government's shoes, essentially, and go ahead with the claim on his own, her own, etc.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand all the nuances of this, but just as a member of the Transportation Finance Committee, I would like to see the bill make it really clear that if the loss or the fraud was attributed to a particular pot of money under a dedicated fund, that fund should be reimbursed as opposed to it going to a general fund.
Representative Simon, could you check that out?
I could
still proceed before it goes to Finance Committee.
In fact, not only that, Representative Holberg, I would be happy to work with you or anyone else, including the department, to make that happen if we can possibly do it. I think that does make sense. If it's from a dedicated pot of money, it should probably go to that dedicated pot of money.
Any other questions? If not, you don't have any testifiers. Does someone want to testify for or against the bill? I believe maybe the department. Anyone here from MnDOT? No. Oh, okay. Representative Duffy?
Yes.
Duffy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, do you know how much money we're going to be saving on this, or how much fraud is currently taking place in our state with this bill? I know we're limiting our questions to financial questions right now. Is that correct?
Representative Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Detsy, it's hard to estimate and know how much fraud would be out there, but I will say this. One advantage of the bill in terms of, I don't know if it's necessarily saving money, but in getting money, and some of you have heard this before in other committees, the federal government in 2006 was impressed enough with the ability of states to recoup fraud, you know, money taken by fraud, that in 2006 Congress sweetened the deal. And Congress said, look, if you states pass a state False Claims Act that meets four criteria, which this does, and I have a memo from House Research saying it does, if you meet these four criteria, then you are going to get a bonus, a 20% bonus, on all the money that you recover in Medicaid fraud cases. So right now the split is 50-50 because that's the pay-in split. The feds pay 50 and we pay 50. So when we recruit fraud in that area in Medicaid, we also split that recovery 50-50. So if we were to get $10 million in ill-gotten gains from fraud in Medicaid today, we would keep $5 million and the feds would get $5 million of that. If we pass this bill, and just by passing it, even if it sits on the shelf forever, it's never used, nobody ever sues under it, it just sits there on the statute books, just as a reward for passing it, if we meet the four criteria, we get a 20% boost, so that from now on, in that $10 million hypothetical, instead of $5 million, we get $6 million, and the Fed gets $4 million instead of $5 million. So that's one way where we automatically get a bonus. And, you know, I didn't bring it with me today, I apologize, but in looking at the recoveries over the last several years, it amounts to many millions of dollars per year just in that bonus money, even if law is never used. Just as a bonus for passing a law, we get $7 million a year. About $2 million a year would be the average that we get.
Representative Dempsey.
Do you know how many states have already passed this law?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dempsey. 22 states and the District of Columbia have already passed it, and it's pending in some others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I believe there's some testifiers from Linda.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm Scott Peterson from Midnight. Just having listened to Representative Simon's comments and talking over the fiscal notes with the people who prepared it, it does appear that there may have been some misunderstanding about the provisions of the bill in determining the cost to MnDOT and as to whether or not it applies to MnDOT employees. So that cost that's associated with that, I mean, it may be that we'd have to go back and re-estimate the fiscal impact for that particular piece. We don't have a position on the bill per se. We rely primarily upon the input of you know, our attorneys and that of the Attorney General in, with regard to whether or not or the extent to which this bill would have an impact on MnDOT. And then with respect to the claims and the recoveries that are estimated in the comments made about the $20,000, I mean, this is just speculation. You know, we tried to come up with a reasonable number with a reasonable number of cases under which this might apply to MnDOT. So, you know, 20,000, I think, was just chosen as a reasonable estimate, and the number of cases too under the same basis. I mean, we could have picked another amount and another sample, but just again trying to come up with something that passed kind of the plausibility test, if you will.
Are there any questions for the testifier, Mr. Peterson? Representative Hover?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Peterson, would you believe it would be the department's position that you would like to see funds recovered from expenditures and various pots of transportation funding money to go back to those pots as opposed to the general fund?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, I think that is a position that we would take. Yeah, any money that would be fraudulently extracted from the Trunk Highway Fund, if it's recovered, we'd like to see it returned to the Trunk Highway Fund.
All right, and if I might, it sounds like you might want to take another run at a fiscal note. Representative Simon, I don't know if this is fast-tracking to the floor, but is it possible to get enough time to allow MnDOT to do an additional fiscal note after we work on some language to make sure that the funds go where they need to go?
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, I'll say what my preference would be, but obviously the preference of this committee is what matters. It would be that we pass it out of here, but that before it gets to hearing and finance, I'd like to work with you, Representative Holbrook, on that amendment, and I can talk with Mark Shepard of House Research, who's been the guru on all of this, about getting something drafted tomorrow. So you and I can maybe by tomorrow afternoon review that, and anyone else on the committee who would like to. And then maybe not by tomorrow, but in short order, the department should come up with a revised fiscal note if it so chooses. That would be my preference.
And Mr. Chair, I'm assuming this will likely have to go through Ways and Means as well, so we have some time. Maybe if we can just have a gentleman's agreement that we have an updated fiscal note before we hit Ways and Means, so we can make sure we know what we're talking about when it comes to the Trunk Highway Fund.
Any further questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions from the committee? Not. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And Representative Hortman, you want to renew the motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would renew my motion that House File 8 be recommended to pass and send back to the Finance Committee.
Right. You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary?
No.
The
thank you, Mr. Chair.
House File 8 is recommended or passed and will be sent to the Finance Committee. Thank you. And while she, it's next one's coming up, has someone looked at your minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Reiner. Move the minutes. Repton Holberg moved the minutes. Okay. That was the minutes of April 14th. Any questions or corrections or additions? Not all in favor say aye.
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 Contrary? No. The minutes are approved. Welcome to the committee, Representative Eden. Someone, go ahead. You have someone to move your bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 1164, recommended to pass, and I assume it's moving to the Finance.
We think it's moving to the floor.
It goes to and moving to the General Register.
Depends on the amendment. You've got a fiscal note right now.
Mr. Chair, I'll amend that to moving to the Finance Committee.
And Mr. Chair, if I might just, given that we're past deadlines, then does the Finance Committee move it to rules? Is that how this works now that we're past second deadline? Or?
Yeah, that's not the problem. Are you asking, there's no deadline for non-finance? Is that what you're asking?
No, Mr. Chair, my understanding is because we're past, what is the third deadline, I guess, then does this still, we were sending it to Finance, and does Finance send it to rules? Or how does
my understanding, Representative Holberg, non-omnibus bills don't have a deadline. Non-omnibus finance. So this would be, wouldn't have to go through rules.
So, Mr. Chair, we just get to keep spending money right up till the end of the year?
It still goes against the target, so it's probably just cut off in a hurry if it isn't there. But they wanted a hearing on the bills, and that'll probably bump the ceiling, I'm sure. Thank you, Representative Holberg. Representative Liebling, you want to present your bill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, this bill's been before this committee before, and it was laid over, I believe.
That's correct.
So I don't know where that puts it formally, but thank you, Representative Morrow, for moving the bill. And
it was laid over, Representative Liebling. That's right. So you can proceed. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we are back to discuss the fiscal note. And when I was here before, and there is a fiscal note on this, and if members recall, this is a bill to stop resuspending licenses for those who are receive a new ticket for driving after suspension. So that's what we're dealing with here. And the Department of Vehicle Services had explained last time we were here why they believed this was going to cost some money to do. Even though the motivation behind this whole bill is to try to relieve some congestion throughout the criminal justice system, because these kinds of cases are clogging the courts, and pretty much everybody that I've spoken to in the justice system, both prosecutors and defense attorneys and judges, all are interested in seeing this go through. But what's in the fiscal note here is $36,000 for fiscal 09, and that is explained in the fiscal note as being for reprogramming of the computer. And then going on from there, we've got the $28,000 every year. So really, frankly, members, this it doesn't make a lot of sense to me why it would be structured in this way. I do understand, though, that the department is looking at some cost for implementing this. So I kind of would like to offer the committee something that Representative Hausman brought up last time I was here. She suggested perhaps putting the effective date out so that to give the department some time to do their reprogramming, because as I understand, they're in the middle of some transition with their computer system. It's a bit disappointing to me, because I think that we need this as soon as we can do it. But I if it's the committee's will, I have an amendment drafted, which members should have, which moves this out, has an effective date of July 1st, 2012, and that should really, I think, remove any fiscal issue in this biennium.
Representative Liebling, would you rather wait for a minute and have testimony from the department, from driver's license?
That would be
first,
just fine.
Then you could make a determination.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Unless there's some questions prior to that, way, if someone from the department would be willing to come up and respond to the question. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. And as Representative Liebling said, if she moves the date out until 2012, that would take care of the programming costs so that we would be able to interface with the court system's computer to be able to get the information we would need about subdivisions within statute sections, and it would be able to be an electronic process versus a manual process, as we discussed at the last committee meeting. The department does not share Representative Liebling's intent in terms of we believe very strongly that we need to have tools like driving after suspension to hopefully help change behavior. But as I said at the committee meeting before, we do have a driver's license sanction committee that is meeting right now that will have a report and some recommendations by September, and those are certainly things for us to look at, because we certainly do agree that people can get into cycles where they keep committing the same violations and we're not seeing an improvement in behavior. And I know that that's one of the things that Representative Liebling has talked about in her prior testimony. And certainly we all share the need to have people look at the consequences of their behavior and learn to act differently, and especially so we can protect public safety. But certainly this would address the fiscal issues that we brought up in our fiscal note.
With that comment, Representative Liebling, would you want to move that amendment?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment.
The members have the A1 amendment in their packet. Do you want to explain the amendment to Representative Liebling again?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the amendment just says that this section is effective July 1st, 2012.
Any questions from the committee? If not, all in favor of the amendment A1, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary. The amendment is adopted. Ms. McCormick, did you have any other comments?
Mr. Chair?
Well, thank you. Representative Colbert.
I mean, it's... seems, I know what you're trying to do with moving the effective date to 2012, and I understand it with the fiscal note, but it seems kind of silly if we're going to have a report in September that this working group, the courts and everybody working together, may come up with a better idea. And I'm a little concerned. Ms. McCormick, can you tell me between now and a year from now what steps will be taken in constructing or RFPs or whatever for your new computer system? That basically what I'm getting at is, if we wait for the recommendations of the committee, will we still be able to accomplish this or other recommendations in the new system that's being planned?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, yes, I would think we would be able to.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that, you know, you want to, Representative Liebling has a bill she wants to pass and wants to get an issue addressed, but it may make more sense to change this bill to provide direction to that working group for things that you want to for sure have them address and get your 2 cents worth in that way, rather than passing a bill with an effective date of 2012 that may be mute after we hear from this working group. So that's just a comment, I guess.
Representative Liebling, you want
well,
to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Colbert, you know, it's been my, first of all, I don't know enough about what the working group is doing, or, you know, I haven't been involved in that, but it's been my observation here that sometimes if you pass legislation, it gets people actually, you know, this being out to 2012, you know, we always will have the opportunity to change or add certain, probably I expect add more of these kinds of provisions rather than retract this one. But I think that sometimes having something like this there gets people to actually do something rather than just keep talking about it. So I think that, and I've had that experience here in different areas. So I think it's still worth doing because, as I said, this is something that has a lot of different sectors have been asking for, and it's unfortunate that Representative Cornish isn't here today because I think you remember at the last hearing he spoke for this rather forcefully. And I understand that the testifier here, they believe there are some policy issues that they're not happy with, but this has been through policy committee. And
well, Mr. Chair, the same organizations that have expressed concern related to having to do something are those same entities that are on this working group. So I just don't want to tie their hands for options because they might come up with something a lot more effective. And so then we might just end up undoing this as a result. So it's just a difference in approach.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I don't think it ties their hands for options. I mean, this is actually a pretty modest proposal of the number of things that probably ought to be done. This is kind of like, because I actually have another bill that does the same thing with driving after revocation and driving after cancellation, and, you know, I'm not trying to move that one, although I actually think, and a lot of other people think, that we ought to be doing the same thing for all of those. So this is kind of starting at the bottom. I think it's very, very unlikely that they'll want to actually not do this. I think it's much more likely that they'll want to move much farther than this in untangling some of this web we've created, because I think most people would tell you that this doesn't modify behavior, and it just has lots of unintended consequences and doesn't really have the effect of getting people to abide by the law, or, you know, certainly getting a ticket does, but getting resuspended doesn't really have the intended effect.
Are there any further questions? We're kind of getting into politics a little bit. Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Any further questions from the committee? If not, Representative Morrill, you want to
Mr. that? Chair, I renew my motion that House File 1164, as amended, be recommended to pass and move to the Finance Committee.
General
Register.
Good finance implication. That's right. Okay. Yeah, I forgot we took the finance portion off. Okay, the motion's been made that House File 1164 be recommended to pass and put on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary?
No.
The House File 1164 is passed and will be placed on a general register.
Thank you very much.
The next bill up is House File 2116, Representative Hansen. Yeah, I know. Representative Hansen, do you have someone to move your bill or not? We'll give Representative Reiner a shot on this one. Actually, this one goes to Finance Representative Reiner. So Representative Reiner moves that House File 2116 be recommended pass and sent to Finance.
Exactly.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, we're only concerned about the component parts, and I see we've got some testifiers, and I think I recognize one of the testifiers, and I might put a time limit on this guy. We're only dealing with finance, so Representative Hansen, if you'd explain your bill and kind of give us an idea on what it deals with finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. This is a fairly short bill. It raises raises a fee $1.50 on vehicle registration and other vehicle transactions, and it allows a credit card payment. That's a short, sweet description of it relating to deputy registrars, and I do have a number of deputy registrars in the audience here who are here for the bill. They want to just raise their hand, and they like the bill.
Representative Hansen, too, maybe unless someone is going to testify to that, would you explain what the fees are and what they'd be raised to?
Okay, the current fee for registration renewals is $4.50, and it would be raised to $6. And for other vehicle transactions, including title transfers, it's $8.50, and it would be raised to $10. And I believe in your packet, you do have not only testimony, but also a fiscal note describing the revenue that comes in.
Representative Hanson, you're probably fortunate that's the savings to the state according to fiscal notes.
Yes.
Are there any questions, Representative Hanson, before we get testifiers? Representative Jeske?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Why is there savings to the state?
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Jeske. The dollar and a half that would come in, if the transaction is done through the state, through the Department of Driver and Vehicle Services, then those dollars are retained by the state. If the transaction is done with a deputy registrar, those dollars are retained by the deputy registrar. So we actually have more transactions occurring, I believe, through the state driver and vehicle services. So that's where the revenue would come from. And Mr. Hurst could correct me if I'm wrong.
Rick and Deputy.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Leader. And also, why, I know you haven't had a raise since 2003. I do have a constituent in my district who has educated me somewhat on this topic. But why a 30% increase? What took you from, what in these crisis times, and I know the cost is passed on to the customer and people that are going to be registering their vehicles and whatever, but 30% in these kinds of financial crisis seems like a lot of money.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I represent the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. To answer your question quite honestly, when we're dealing with such relatively low amounts in what the filing fee is, a modest increase of only a dollar does appear to be a 30% increase, as you suggest. The sad thing is, though, that the business model under which the deputies have operated under just in this decade alone has changed so dramatically that their costs have been increasing dramatically. They're also facing, quite honestly, competition from the state as well. 10 years ago, the state did not offer online renewals for tabs, nor did they include an envelope with the renewal notice so that the individual citizen has the option of just putting a check in the mail, and that goes directly to the state as opposed to our deputy offices. Just in that one category alone, Representative Debke, we've seen a decrease of 30% just in that category of business. And certainly we're all about customer service, and if that's what the customer wants, that's what we will certainly support. We're not here to say the state should shut down their internet renewal service or their envelope. But it does make a dramatic impact on our operations, and at the same time, prior to 2000, everything was done with paper forms. You'd come into the office, and at the end of the day, everything was put together on paper, and these large packets would be mailed off to the state. Well, of course, now we're computerized, and computers don't last forever. They tend to have a shelf life of perhaps 2 to 3 years, and there's also additional equipment, scanners, certainly fax machines were still around in the 90s, but there's printers and toner costs. And incidentally, the paperwork is still being done by deputies because not everything can be done on the computer. Those forms used to be supplied to us by the state, but now because of computers, we have to download those off online and print them up at our cost as well. So it's a combination of these things and other expenses, labor, for example. The Deputy Registrar Network is responsible for transferring $1 billion a year to the state of Minnesota. And it should be pointed out, we do not receive any type of subsidy, for the most part, from the state to conduct this business. And we're very proud of the fine service that we perform. But given the fact that the dollar amounts that we deal with, and combined with the sensitive data that we deal with as well, we have labor costs that are real. We cannot just hire anyone. We have to make sure that they're appropriate for the job. So Yes, it's a 30% increase, but given the low amount of what that fee is to start with, it doesn't take much to make it look large in a percentage basis.
Did that answer your question, Rusty?
Yes, it did. I do have one more, if that's all right, Chairman. The other one was, I know this is, that the cap is in statute, correct? Is that why this is coming to our committee? So is this now commensurate with what the state is charging for people that are not independent registrars?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman and Representative Debke, there's no difference between the fee that the state charges if the individual goes through the state or through a deputy registrar, and these fees are set in statute, as you said.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Chairman Mita. I appreciate that. So, in essence, we're increasing the state fees at the same time. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman,
do I understand that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Debke, it would be difficult to differentiate between the two because the state has to mail notice of a renewal to the individual. So it would be very confusing to the individual to receive a renewal notice that says your cost is $99 plus $4.50 if you go this route or $6 if you go that route. Quite honestly, we believe that we should be on an even playing field as far as the fees are concerned.
Thank you very much, Chairman Mita. I just wanted clarification on what it was that we were...
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this question is for Representative Hansen or maybe even Mr. Kane, who's been around here a while, but my recollection is that there's a major impediment issue to using credit cards because of the fees that the counties and everybody's been trying to do it for years. There's a credit card study that got presented to the local government committee, and it has something to do with the surcharge or how the contract is structured between the credit card companies and Representative Hansen's shaking his head. I don't know if he can tell us what the issues are around that, but my recollection is that there's some problem with us allowing credit card use, and if the problem still exists, and by doing this we're going to open this up on a large scale, I don't know, maybe it's Ms. McCormick that can answer this, but I'm wondering what has changed that this is an acceptable option.
Representative Holberg, I think Mr. Burris would like to respond.
Mr.
McCormick. Anybody? Phone a friend? Anybody?
Mr. McCormick's coming up.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick with DVS. And Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, the study that we just completed in February did demonstrate that it would be difficult for us to be able to pay the convenience fees for customers if we allowed our customers to just use all the credit cards that they wanted in face-to-face transactions, because the Visa credit card company will not allow a customer to pay a convenience fee. MasterCard, Discover, and American Express will. But about the estimates we learned were about 60-some percent of all Minnesotans have a Visa credit card. We wrote to the Visa and asked them if Minnesota could serve as a pilot project and if we could be allowed to have our customers use credit cards and pay for the convenience fee, and Visa turned us down. And so our recommendation in the report was that for the only way that we would see us to be able to afford to be able to allow credit cards to be used by our customers which the deputy registrar certainly supports, and we have customers that support this, would be to have the customer pay the convenience fee at the time of the transaction. That would mean, though, that people that have a Visa credit card would not be able to use that credit card to pay for the transaction. And so I don't have that report with me, and so I don't remember what the amount was that we would need to raise in our fees and in taxes in order to be able to do that, but it was substantial. And we did not support our being able to do that. But we have had some discussions in terms of going forward with that recommendation. I think the department has talked with the Department of Management and Budget about having discussions with the State Bank, who does all the financial transactions under contract with the state, and we at least have to have those discussions to see if they would be able to provide the service for BBS and its agents. And so that's kind of where we're at right now with the credit cards.
Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair, I think isn't another component of it is because of the constitutional dedication of the funds to the various, you can't like mix them or whatever. And so we're kind of between a rock and a hard place here with no real good place to go.
Ms. McCormick, that's correct. Do you have any further questions of Ms. McCormick?
I do not. I'm just wondering if the bill author has a solution to this, or...
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, I think that when you look at the bill on lines 1.18 and 1.19, the keywords there are may, not shall, so it's not directing the agency or the deputy registers to do this. It's may, and that they may, work on getting this the credit card established. Now, I've been away from state government for, I think, a little over four years here, but it seems to me in the agency where I used to work that they did take credit cards for payments on site. They may not have done it online, but my memory seems to be that was a change right before I left. And I can double check on that, but there is a cost that comes with not having the capacity to be taking credit cards, and that is the bad checks that occur when you're, and the costs that are involved with chasing the bad checks that are there. And so with the credit card, you've got a high number of people who want to use credit cards or debit cards. We are having increased costs with bad checks that are occurring there. Having the ability and the capacity to use credit cards, I think, provides some protection against the cost of the bad check.
Representative Holbert.
Well, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, the way I read this, I read it as that you're giving the consumer the right to use a credit card.
Correct.
The way I read it, it says a consumer can use a credit card. And the other thing is that it seems that it's only referencing the fees. So are you saying the fees and the taxes can be paid by credit card, or only the fees?
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding from Mr. Hurst that it's both could be paid with credit cards. We have here the words fee may be paid by credit card. What 1.18 says is may be paid by credit card. It doesn't say may be paid by Visa credit card. So it's giving the consumer the choice. They may not be able to take Visa, but they may have the capacity to take.
Mr. Hurst, you're getting pretty nervous. Would that be a very short dissertation you're going to give us now?
Advice well taken, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, again, we're interested in the customer service. Customers are asking. But
Mr. Chair, I understand that. I don't need that cold speech again. I think we heard from Ms. McCormick that they don't have the capacity to do this in their system, that there's still questions about it. And I'm not even so sure that this language even covers all the other cost of the transaction. The way I read it is the fee imposed upon under paragraph A, may be paid by a credit card. So I'm not, I know it's late and people want to get this moving, but I think there's problems with this that have to be fixed before you are ready for prime time.
Well,
Representative Hansen, you have any comment or not?
I'd be willing to work on that between here and the next stop if that's needed.
You might check it. I don't know.
Clarifying, maybe council can provide some clarifying language.
If there's no comment, any further questions? We have other testifiers too. Did you complete your testifying, Mr. Hurston?
I'm finished, Mr. Chairman, and the two testifiers that I have lined up, I have advised them in advance to be very brief and succinct to the point, and I say that again to make sure they hear me.
We do have two. Grace, Councilor Warren. Would you welcome to the committee? Would you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Yes, Jeff Worth, Deputy Registrar from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm the legislative chair of the Deputy Registrar Association. And I want to thank the chair and the members of the committee for the opportunity to speak today. And I believe I am the one that you were referring to earlier about being long-winded. So I apologize for that first impression. We are here again to discuss the bill before us today about the increase in fees as sort of a sounding board for the deputy registrars throughout the state of Minnesota. I feel it's my duty to come forward when our fees get out of adjustment. Many times if a particular office around the state will get in trouble, one of us on our board will be contacted about the challenge. Many times, as you're well aware, cities and counties, most of our membership, about 60% are cities and counties. What's one of the changes in the past 10 years is that they have enterprise budgets within their city or county. And the county commissioners, city councilmen look at these budgets very carefully, and the individuals in charge of the office, the deputy registrar office, will have to justify their budget and make sure that they're handling the precious city and county resources diligently. And what will happen if the budget begins to look out of sync, the individual in charge of the office will have to explain the challenges, and in some cases the city or county will start to entertain notions of doing away with the office. And when that happens, and we are called, Grace on my left, she was active around the state in giving cost saving measures for deputy registrars, different techniques to be effective and efficient. And our association does that. We work closely with the Department of Public Safety, Director McCormick. We meet monthly with them and discuss the different challenges that we face in a collaborative manner. Very quickly to address the credit card issue that came up earlier, the citizens do want and expect us to take credit cards, and we are hoping that as time progresses, we will be able to accept credit cards as part of our process and procedure as well. And with that, I'll
have Ms. Wachler-Warren.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name for the record is Grace Wachler-Rowett from the city of White Bear Lake. And I will try to be brief and hit two points today that I think you need to be aware of. One is, as Mr. Orr said, that most of the deputy registrars are public entities. And as such, we are operated as a standalone, meaning that $4.50 or that $8.50 has to cover all our costs, just as in a private business. We cannot raise our local taxes in order to fund this service to our citizens. We are standalone. So we are asking for a raise, so to speak, to operate.
to provide the service that our citizens truly deserve. I'll interrupt Representative Demmer.
Did you finish your testimony?
I noticed his hand, so I wanted to interrupt to respond to any concerns you have.
I'd appreciate if you could finish your testimony, then we'll get to
questions. I forgot where I left off. The enterprise budget, that it is standalone. And yes, it is true. It's a difficult economic time right now, but you do need to understand that we've been working on this way before the economy went down. We have been talking to the offices throughout the state, and right now, from the anecdotes that I've had discussions with particularly outstate, I see approximately 30% of those offices are barely breaking even or losing money. So we need this. We're in desperate, dire need to have these funds in order to operate and provide the services that our citizens need. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Demmer, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was interesting. I don't think I've ever had that happen before. when I've been called upon by
their hands.
That's pretty reactive. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, first a little comment. I think this is a frustration that we all probably feel here is we have a quasi-public-private relationship, and we are in control of, we set the rates and the pricing, which is interesting in a quasi-private situation, but that's just a comment. The question I have for you, and as in my former life, I farmed, and so I had trucks, and I've had cars, and I had vehicles in my stores, and I know that there are different needs. When I would go to register my semi, for example, I learned quickly that it's not the same as registering a car. And the costs, of course, were different, and I would have appreciated being able to use a credit card, by the way, because it's a little more expensive when you're registering a semi. But anyway, there's this prorating and some different things, and of course, as a farmer, there are different things. But my question for you is, as we look at your fee structures, there's been changes. We now have online registration. It's very difficult for me to do that with my truck, but I can with my car, or I can send it in. And so that's changed your financial situation, your mix of business, if you will. Could you speak to that a little bit, whoever wants to, how that's changed, what the costs have done for people who have different types of vehicles, and, if you will, a little introspect into what you have to look at in terms of your mix of revenues for your business.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Representative Demmer. That is a very key point as far as the skill set is needed for our employees. Yes, it's very easy to renew those tabs. That's why it can be done online. It's a simple, hey, thank you very much, here you go. But we get the difficult ones that have to be done face-to-face. We have to have a knowledge base that is incredible. For example, to train an individual, just to know the very minimum basics is a minimum of 1 year on-the-job training. We have worked extremely closely with the BDS in order to have certification and training, in fact, so that there's a consistency and a high standard of training of our individuals. But with that comes a cost. Not only do we have to have an individual that's computer literate, that can do data entry, they have to know all the laws and regulations, as well as keeping up on all the changes that occur every year, as we know, that are passed by various bills. So, yes, we get the more complex ones, and that's why our $8.50 long form app is more, is for that degree. And that's why we need to have it increased further, is because of that knowledge base and the extent of taking a renewal could be 30 seconds to 45 seconds. A long, complex transaction could take anywhere from a minute to 25 to 30 minutes, and that's one-on-one explaining those prorated semis, etc. And so that's averaging it out. That's why we're asking for a reasonable $10 fee.
Any further questions, Representative Demmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's helpful. And I'll never forget my most interesting time. Just a little divergence. I had one of my trucks. We had a seasonal license, and I forgot to renew the license, and they took off to haul grain, and of course got pulled over by one of our finest. And it was sitting underneath an underpass, sitting still. And I got a phone call and said, "You got to get that license now, or the truck's not moving." And it was sitting in the street, so I had to go to my deputy registrar and learn what I had to do. But so that was one of the half hour deals. But my question has to do with you had a certain mix of business where a certain amount of your income came from individual cars versus mid-sized trucks versus heavy trucks or whatever. Can you talk about that mix and how that's changed for your, in your revenues, in your revenue stream? I don't know what the percentages are, how much money you plan from whatever, and I know it's different from district to district or office to office, but can you talk about the change in that mix? You know, I'm guessing if you used to have 75% cars, maybe it's 50% now or something, I don't know.
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, yes, our co-partners, BVS, because of their internet renewal and the mail-ins, we've lost 30% of those renewals, the short forms. So the bulk of our transactions are those long, complex ones. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, versus the cars.
Mr. Chair, if I will. I'm sure that at some point in time, maybe 20 years ago, a certain percentage of your revenue came from vehicle renewals, and a certain percentage of your revenue came from mid-range trucks or whatever, and a certain, however you break it down. I don't know how you break it down. In the parts business, I know how we break down our revenues and look at our market, but you must do the same, and I'm just wondering how that's changed, however you break it down.
Mr. Chair, that's a very difficult question to answer because each office is unique and it's based on the community. For example, in White Bear Lake, I'm fortunate or unfortunate, depending upon how you look at the economy, but I have a lot of dealerships up and down Highway 61. So in my particular office, I do 60 to 70% of the long, difficult transactions, and the balance would be the renewals. My colleague, Mr. Orris, may have a more different percentage. For example, I know the St. Paul office across the street primarily does renewals. Sorry, but, yeah, I think I'm going to pass it over to Mr. Orris.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, different offices do have a different mix, but I think what Representative Demmer is asking is what was it, say, 10 years ago, and approximately a third of the total renewals are actually going through the internet and the mail at this time. So it has changed the volumes away from some of the renewals as a percent. Are it'd be somewhat similar if there was a Napa store and people bought their parts online and bypassed their local service provider in Gaston, Minnesota. So that would definitely be to their detriment.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Do you have any further questions?
Well, just
we're kind of getting in maybe a little policy. We should stick to finance.
Well, my last comment, Mr. Orris, and those my he hit a little close to home with the Napa stores and the online.
Any further questions or testifiers? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
We have a person who wants to testify, I believe, in opposition.
But he's smiling as he says. I always do.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I am John Kavanaugh. I'm with Cook Hill Girard Associates, and we represent Enterprise Rent-A-Car. And Enterprise Rent-A-Car takes great pride in actually registering its vehicles within the state in which they're operated. Again, this is a fairly unusual practice, but it does constitute for a lot of registration fees in Minnesota. Enterprise Car Rental looks upon any increase in registration fees as actually discouraging this policy. And it also reduces our competitiveness within the industry as well. So we are not a fan of these increased fees. And with that, I will stand for questions, and I thank you for your time.
Mr. Kavanaugh, how big is your fleet?
Mr. Chair, I neglected to actually bring that information, but I will gladly provide you with that information.
Just another question. Do you register some outside of the state? I know you keep them out, but they aren't all domiciled here, but you don't register them just what you have domiciled here, right?
You're absolutely correct. Because you have movement between states of vehicles, not all vehicles are registered in Minnesota. That being said, most of the vehicles in Minnesota are operated in Minnesota and therefore are registered in Minnesota.
Again, I don't want to dominate this, but Mr. Kavanaugh, you also have competitors like Hertz and all of those. They aren't in the audience. Are you peculiar to the system or what?
The industry, Mr. Chair, the industry is a little unusual, or at least Enterprise, how they operate is a little unusual in that a lot of car rental organizations will actually register their vehicles in states which have low fees and low taxes. Again, Enterprise takes pride in actually doing it within the state they are operated.
As long as I'm questioning, is it your opinion these others are registering outside of the state then?
That is correct.
Okay.
Or many of them are.
Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Your line of question is where I was going to go, and I thought I was going to stay quiet until they answered the next part of my question, which was, what does determine where you register your vehicles, and is there incentive for companies to register their vehicles in other states? How do we compare? So, two questions. You kind of answered one already, because it sounds like you have flexibility as to where you register vehicles. You choose to do it within the states, others do not. I think that sounds like it's something they could just do. I'll just say that. But the next question is how do we compare, and are we uncompetitive and actually going to lose revenue if we do increase the fees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, I can't actually answer whether or not Enterprise will not be registering their vehicles, but I do know that it actually acts as a hurdle to them doing that because it's a very low margin as far as profit making, and I know that any little fee, anything like that, provides a burden for them, and industries do look where they can actually make their best savings, and I would say that this might be one of them.
Any further questions? Representative Hartman.
Well, I have a question for Mr. Burris, and maybe he doesn't know the answer, and I don't mean to put him on the spot, but do you know if there's any legal requirement in Minnesota that if a vehicle, for example, by Enterprise or me, is purchased and intended for use in Minnesota, if that individual or corporation is supposed to get the vehicle registered here?
Mr. Chair, members, there are legal requirements for individuals who reside in Minnesota to register their vehicles here, but I'm not sure offhand about corporations or vehicles that are rented out. I'd have to take a look at that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your patience. I don't want to keep us here all night, but I'm just learning on this. Is there a reason that we are setting the fees? And this sounds like this is a private business. You're working in a competitive market. Is there a reason why our registrars have to charge the same fee that the state wants to charge? I mean, why are we setting the fees at all? If it's a private business, why are we getting involved in that? I need to know. Just learn.
Probably, Mr. Kavanaugh, that's not your area. Representative Hanson, you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Epstein, I believe, I don't have a long history with this, but I believe that the reason is that this is a public service and that you have a public, you're providing a service to people, online services, or when it was just state driver and vehicle services, you had a whole network that was set up for deputy registrars to be able to provide a service to Minnesotans, and that the fees that were there helped cover those costs. So the local property taxpayers were not doing that. There are some private entities that are out there as deputy registrars, but those exist where the public service is not being provided by the public entity. So you have the state, I think, setting those fees, and I don't know the legislative history on how long that has been, but that the statute, what I'm doing is not creating statute, but I am amending existing statute for fees.
Thank you, Mr. Leader. I have no problem with anyone making money in a business at all. That's not what I'm all about. I just am concerned about us tying the hands of our private business owners who, if, for instance, if they wanted to keep Enterprise as a good customer, to give them a bulk rate, or, a lot of private companies would do that. But it sounds like since we are legislating the fee, we are not allowing our registrars to be that flexible in maintaining and growing their businesses and keeping their businesses alive. And it's just, I don't understand why we do it that way, but apparently that's what we're doing.
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Epstein,
Mr. Kavanaugh approached me on my way over from the Capitol over to here, so I haven't had the opportunity to work with him in detail on this. The bill was introduced a while ago, but this was bringing up, and I'm interested in talking with him or any of the other companies that are involved in this.
I think there's a couple questions, not questions, but Representative Deftey, a lot of the registrars are public too, and I don't know. I think we'd have to check the statute. I don't know, Mr. Kavanaugh, if you can please register like you do others. I don't know if that's, but it's something probably Representative Hassan should check. I do have some questions here, Representative Detmer.
Or
Dammer, okay.
Oh,
she gave me the wrong name.
Happens all the time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question. Can you charge less than the fee? Can a deputy registrar charge less than the fee that is in statute? I just read through it. It doesn't. It appears that this is the amount, $450. Can I charge $350 if I want to get Enterprise's business? Or do I have to charge that amount?
Representative.
Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, it says is imposed, so I don't think it's an opportunity. It appears to be an is.
Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to get a little history on this because I know it's in the last couple years we've had some fee increases, Chair, and I was wondering if Representative Morrill, I think it was last year or the year before, that we put a $1.50 charge on for the computer system.
Representative Morrill.
Representative Stevenson, you're right. I believe it was $1.75. It was to pay for the computer system that we've heard about a few times already today over at DBS. The public can tell us more, but and I don't know whether that's added to the $450 or what. I think Ms. McCormick probably could give us a more brief and succinct answer to that.
Representative
Stevens. Yeah, please, Mr. Chair.
We're pushing our time limit to Representative Swales.
I will pass. Mr. Chair, I was going to ask Commissioner McCormick to come down.
Bring her back. She is. Okay. Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, just the fees are set in statute as you were stating, Representative Morrill and Representative Severson, and DVS went to a fee-based system, as some of you may remember, in 2005. And we went to that kind of a system because of the fact that we were collecting tax money and trunk highway fund on the vehicle side and on the trunk highway money on the driver's license side. And we felt it'd be more appropriate if we would look at what our costs would be in terms of the transaction costs. And so we proposed that in the 2005 session, and they went into effect in August of 2005, so fiscal year 06 is when that happened. And as Representative Morrow stated last year, we asked for $1.75. It's a temporary technology surcharge that's $1.75 to help us pay for the computer system, and that's added to all the transactions that we do. So it's the deputy registrars are talking about vehicle transactions in this legislation, but that $1.75 is also added to driver's license transactions on the other side. And so that's how we pay for our services within our division, as well as that's the fees that the deputy registrars and our driver's license agents are able to keep to maintain their businesses.
Representative Wales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think what I would like to ask of Commissioner McCormick is to get back at Representative Deputy's question. I think the question was, why do we have the business model where deputy registrars can either be privately owned or also publicly created, and I believe that was your question, and I think all of us probably would benefit from an explanation.
If you could, Ms. McCormick, technically we're getting into policy. Our position here is what's the fee increase, but if you could do that, we'd appreciate that. Respond to that.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I myself have only been with Driver and Vehicle Services for 9 years, and there's a long history of our agents serving as the face of DVS with customers across the state. And so they certainly are, they do represent us in doing business, and and they have been in existence for a long time. I don't know the exact year, but they have certainly served us. There's 173 of them. I think that there was a desire to have representation across the state, and there were not always governments that wanted to take that service on, is what I've assumed and what I've heard. And so there were also private businesses that also acted on behalf of the state. And so that's why we have the mix of the private and the public, because they're all doing our business. And the, and that was why we set up this fee-based system. And normally in legislation that involves our agents, the department tries hard to be to remain neutral on those provisions, and we would usually be neutral, but in these times the department is not able to support this legislation because of the fact of the fee increase that's involved. It is not to say that our deputies do not work hard and they do the people's business. They probably do a little, they do about 73% of the tab renewals, but certainly they are our face in terms of motor vehicle transactions, because the only transactions we do at DVS are the tab renewals online, and that's only about 6%, and a little around 20% maybe are we get for through mail registration. And so they certainly do that, do our work. And so I certainly wouldn't take anything about away about the fact that they have certainly business costs that are associated with that. But that's just kind of my the statement I needed to make today.
Yeah. You have a follow-up?
Mr. Chair.
No,
yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could get just some follow-up on that. So the $1.75 that is tagged on for the fee is set apart from the $4.50 that we currently see here. When you go online, you see that fee. It says $4.50 and then another $1.75 for technology fees. This would change this to $6 and $1.75 for technology fees. Do I have that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, that the $1.75 on the online is not have to do with the technology surcharge. That is already incorporated in the fee that you're paying. So this would involve $1.75. There's an additional $1.75 when you do it online, because we have to pay the bank for the encryption that's done, so that none of that financial and private data that you enter on the online transaction is could be intercepted in any way. And so we have additional costs that we have to pay to the bank in order to have that website secure, so that we do not have any problems with any identity theft or fraud. And so there's an additional $1.75 that's involved in that transaction, and that's very difficult for customers to understand. So
notably so. Yeah. Just one more follow-up. Okay, so let's go back 6 years. What was the previous registrar's fee before all of the transpired, the $4.50 and the $1.75? Okay, so originally there was the license fee, and then there was the registrar's fee, and that was...
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, at that time I was overseeing just the driver services part of DVS, and I'm not positive. I was thinking it was $3.50 in those days. It was $3.50 for tab renewal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, Ms. McCormick, I have a deputy register near me, and that's what I use whenever I go there. There's always somebody in there, so I know they're providing a great service. Now, and I haven't done the online, obviously. So, okay, so if you're online, you're going to pay $1.75. So what would be the difference in going paying, if you're getting online, you're paying the extra $1.75 versus when you go into the deputy registrar's and just paying $2 at that point in time?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, you would still pay the filing fee, so you'd pay the $4.50 and you'd pay whatever your registration tax renewal fee is, and then you still pay the $1.75 surcharge that's added on. If you are going to the online on the bank, when you get inside the bank, well, you get inside the financial part, they add $1.75 that we pay the bank in order to do our online credit card transactions. And the deputy registrar, you wouldn't pay that an additional $1.75 because that money just goes to cover our costs with the bank.
Okay, but the only... It's only if you're online that you need to pay the extra $1.75. Is that right?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, there's two different charges. There's a temporary technology surcharge that every DVS customer pays on their transactions, $1.75. Then there's this additional $1.75 that you pay for what we would call a customer convenience fee. For the use of the credit card, because we then have to pay the credit card company and the bank in order to do that service.
Okay, that I understand.
Okay.
Representative Anson, I think we had a lot of discussion there. You represented are ready to wrap it up.
Mr. Chair,
unless
it's
there are
been
further
a very
questions,
good policy discussion.
Maybe I should just. Are there further questions that need to be asked? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, once the year and a half or whatever goes by, then these fees are going to go down by $1.75.
I understand it's temporary.
Because it's built in, but it's temporary. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? If not, let's see. Representative Reinert.
I renew my own motion.
And that was suspended. Fast and send to the Finance Committee.
Correct.
That, did you have any further closing comments, Representative Hanson?
Thank you.
Well, you heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary. The House File 2116 is passed and will be sent to the Finance Committee. And before the committee leaves, this should be our last meeting, and I want to make certain that I think everybody recognizes the staff, the work that they've done, and especially Mr. Burris, Corinne Zures, Abby Mayen, and Susie, and Dan Kane. And the pages was vital. Dan White there. Oh, right. I couldn't think of it. Yeah, Peter, I'm thinking of Vitali and Peterson, or Grafstrom, right, forgot the name, because without them we certainly couldn't function. We really appreciate it. So thank you. I believe this is the last meeting for this session, although we probably will have some informational meetings coming up. I think we've got some good informational meetings. We'll probably have some... meetings prior to some of the bills that are coming up that we're aware of. Representative
Leader, before we go, as a freshman, I must tell you that you have been an absolutely wonderful chairman. I have enjoyed very much the way you conduct your meetings. You're a gentleman, you're courteous, and you're organized. And this has been a pleasure to serve with you on this committee.
Thank you, even if I pronounce the O-E and the E-O wrong.
Join the rest of the group.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. The meeting's adjourned.